From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a little boy learned how to ride a bike. That is an exciting moment for many parents, but it was a moment one family didn't know that they would get to experience. A local woman named Megan has been sharing her son Cooper's story in an effort to help other families like hers. Megan says Cooper is vibrant, inquisitive, empathetic, and her hero. That's because when Cooper was born, he was diagnosed with several conditions, including two neurological disorders that affected his fine motor skills and speech development. Sensory processing disorder also made the world frightening and overwhelming for him at times. Megan says noises, smells, touch, light, clothing, foods, and more were overstimulating. When Cooper was a year and a half, Megan noticed Cooper wasn't his happy, bubbly self anymore. She says he was frustrated and rarely happy. That's when she realized she needed outside support, and she turned to the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. And after working with a speech therapist, a physical therapist, and an occupational therapist over the last several years, Megan says her Cooper is back. He's made progress in therapy. He's attended preschool classes. And again, as we mentioned, even learned how to ride a bike. We've invited Megan to share Cooper's story with us this hour. And while it's one family's experience, the process Megan navigated and some of the challenges she faced are common among many parents whose children require special services. This hour, we'll explore how to work through that process. We'll talk about the kinds of speech and physical therapies and OT is available to kids like Cooper. We'll also talk about the current state of EI, Early Intervention Services. It's part of our annual Dialogue on Disability Week, and more on that in just a moment. But first, let me welcome our guests, and Cooper's mother is Megan. She's here. Welcome. Thanks for being here to share the story.
Thank you for having me.
Also, welcome to Dr. Sarah Callis, who is a physical therapist and the lead physical therapy and occupational therapy clinician at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Hello to Deborah Cicery, who is a licensed speech pathologist at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Valerie Stotz as well, as a licensed speech pathologist and preschool administrator. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, this is the first in our series of conversations about inclusion and disability rights 2020. It's part of our annual Dialogue on Disability Week, a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies. As part of this week's programming, WXXI TV is also airing a number of television shows and films highlighting the disability community. You can learn more about speech and communication development in an upcoming special about a boy who was born profoundly deaf and is now an award-winning chef. The show is called Chef Darren, The Challenge of Profound Deafness. It airs on Saturday at 4 p.m. on WXXI TV. So, Megan, welcome. And it's just great
Thank
to
you.
Have you here. And why don't you tell us just a little bit about Cooper today, and then we're going to kind of work back and work through the story. But he is how old now?
Cooper is 5 now.
How's he doing?
He's doing really well. He's starting to definitely come out of his shell, and he's just amazing.
Let's kind of walk through his story here, and why don't you tell me about what you knew about the diagnosis and how early that came, birth, and kind of take me through those early stages.
Well, as far as birth, I didn't know anything was profoundly wrong at, you know, and I guess I wouldn't call it wrong, but he was a fussy, colicky baby, and he just always seemed to hit those milestones late. And what was frustrating is you have these milestones, right, and then you are told, well, don't compare your child to other children, and yet here are the milestones that they're supposed to hit. And we worked very closely with his pediatrician, and he was fussy, he was whiny, he never seemed super comfortable. He wanted to be consoled, and yet at the same time, he wasn't huggy and lovey. He rolled over very late. He never really crawled per se. He pulled himself up, and if he did something like a crawl, he kind of dragged almost like his legs behind him.
Were you noticing in these developmental moments, were you sort of cognizant even early on of, hey, you know, the milestone says X, but I am being told not
yes.
to obsess about it. Tell me a little bit about that push-pull that you feel.
So I definitely did notice it, and I always was speaking in communication with his pediatrician. And at that time, well, you know, let's keep an eye on it. So it was noted. It was just that nobody, I think, really wanted to jump to a conclusion of anything. What really prompted it was when he was a little bit before two. And, you know, kids go from babbling and cooing to their speech kind of moves to where it sounds like they're trying to actually put things together that sound more like words. And his first word was dada. His other word that's really not a word was agu, but it sounded more like speech. And all of a sudden it was gone. He stopped saying it, and he almost seemed to revert back to just like these garbled little infant sounds. And then he seemed very frustrated, and the look in his eye was just different. And then that's when I was like, yeah, something's not right.
How long did it take you to notice that? As you're kind of describing, I think what you're describing is almost like a step back when it comes to speech. But do you notice in a day, in a week?
Probably a week's worth of time, when all of a sudden just the words weren't
sure
there. The expressions, even the physical expressions on his face weren't.
You're not thinking, well, he's sick or he's just a little off. You're thinking,
I thought, well, what happened? Like, honestly, I took him to the doctor. I'm like, well, did something actually happen? Like, did he have a stroke? Mm-hmm. Did something physically happen to him that I was not aware of? So then he said, I don't think he had anything happened to him, but let's get him evaluated.
So what happened next?
So I contacted early intervention, and from there I filled out all the paperwork and got somebody to come to the house and evaluate him. And the time frame for evaluating him, it was like, I want to say 4 or 5 days before his second birthday. So they actually evaluated him as a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. Because if you evaluate too early, it depends on what scale that you're on. So with that, they were actually able to evaluate him almost in two separate manners. And they're like, yeah, he definitely needs some speech. It wasn't evident at the time, because he was still so young, that he needed PT or OT, because they were also looking at how long he could focus or not focus. He was still too little. Mm-hmm. He was mobile, but...
I beg to differ.
Hold on. Go ahead, Dr. Kaus. Go ahead. You can correct the record there.
That's what I was told. He was still too little.
Yes. I'm not saying that you are wrong, Megan, but there really isn't such a thing as too young for the other therapies. And often we walk before we talk. So there may and likely were, especially in your description of him with the not really crawling, that's not really a good thing. Right. A lot of motor development happens with crawling. So he may have benefited even then from some of the PTOT stuff.
Right.
And our health system as it is doesn't always do a great job of identifying those motor deficiencies as early as speech. Because a lot of parents I meet will say, I just want them to talk. I understand that. But we walk before we talk. And they're really interconnected.
Boy, I have no doubt so many listeners are relating to the challenge that you feel about looking at milestones. When's this supposed to happen? When's it long enough after that milestone was supposed to happen that I should be worried? What do I do or not do? How do I not overreact? But I mean, these are so sensitive. And if you've been a parent, you've probably been in that spot. Let me also ask you, Megan, I mean, I have this sort of thing where one little thing is off with me and I start to self-diagnose. I look up, I Google. I'm sure everyone in the medical field can't stand that we do that. I mean, I have this little eczema spot on my arm that I was convinced was either, you know, sort of scabies or, you know, some sort of amputation-worthy event. And
right.
I mean, like, that's what we do, right?
We
get online and we're going to try to figure out how much were you at that point before you even had an idea? Did you have thoughts in your mind of, I hope it's this, or I wonder if it's this.
I don't know if it was hoping that it was one or the other, but I definitely Googled, which, you know, is a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
And then with that, I was like, okay, maybe I should really go to the library. You know, let's go where, you know, maybe something's more reliable, because anything can get put out there on the internet. The biggest thing is, I didn't want to just read it for myself and assume. I was constantly talking to his pediatrician, constantly, because, you know, he got the veil and the diagnosis. Okay, we started speech, and I kept thinking, something's still not right. something's still off. And when someone at first said, well, you know, behaviorally, and I'm like, no, stop, time out. I'm not just going to peg it on on behavioral. So it was, okay, well, let's go a little further. And then I was figuring that if I could get him enough to communicate, was it a behavior based on frustration? And then if I could try to eliminate that, then maybe, okay, I could take the behavior portion. But it didn't help. There, it almost was more tangled and more confusing the minute he could speak or communicate, because it's not like he just started talking. We did sign language. We did certain things to try to make sure that there was.
And this is when he's how old?
Two.
So before we kind of continue through Cooper's story, I'm going to ask all three other guests here if you would like to advise all listeners about whether to Google or not Google their own health. Because I think what Megan honestly did, it sounds like she did, at least from my perspective, I'm guessing this is what you should do, which is try to learn as much as you can, but don't from there make the diagnosis yourself. You know, kind of arm yourself with as much as you can, but then go to the professionals, which I'm sure she's glad that she did. But what would you say to people about the precariousness of Googling your own health or your child's health?
There are many very good publications that can talk about ages and stages, different developmental milestones. Your pediatrician is an excellent resource. And it is true. Sometimes you have to really advocate for your child and keep going back. They spend a few minutes with you. So you as the parent to speak up and say, this just doesn't seem right to me, or they seem different, or they don't look to me as though they're doing the things other kids are doing. And then call the county, 753-KIDS. I learned the number. I didn't have it last time. To call the county and get an evaluation. Go get some professionals in to take a look. They may say there's really nothing going on right now and we're going to keep an eye on this child. Or they can say this really does look like something. I have done a lot of work with the speech therapists and the occupational therapists at our agency and the special educators to look for the motor milestones, to refer for PT or OT. Because it really, kids are dynamic systems. It's not going to be one thing. It's rarely one thing, I should say. Googling is not bad. There's a lot of info out there. But take that information and then reach out to the professionals that are available to you.
Just as Megan did. Go ahead.
I want to piggyback off Sarah as well, that when you are the parent, you know your child the best. And even though, and just like Sarah said, when the doctor says, oh, this is fine, because they're seeing kids develop in such a range. It's not like at this age he should have this and every single child shall. However, you've got that gut feeling as a parent. So you know that, wait a minute, there's more than that. And as Sarah said, it's no harm in finding out. When you get evaluated, there's sometimes your evaluation results say, he's fine. He's within the normal range. Don't worry about it. Or he needs help, and you want to get that as early as you can. So that's why just getting the evaluation, rather than self-diagnosing on Google and trying to self-treat, this is the way to do it. But the 753 kids, let me just say, is for early intervention below the age of 3. When they're 3 to 5, the place you go is your school district to contact to get evaluating. Once you get, we have so many people that will just say, he'll grow out of it, he'll be fine, you know, don't worry about it, wait. If you just get evaluated, then you'll know, and you'll know you can get treatment right away.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Deborah?
I think you do need to trust yourself as a parent. I think your pediatrician is able to see your child for just a few minutes and is drawing some conclusions based on what you say, but what they observe in the office. The same is true for an evaluation. We take an hour, sometimes we take as long as 2 hours to look at this child, and they may be having a good day, they may be having a bad day, but ultimately you know your child best. And if you really don't feel like the evaluation was reflective of what you see at home, don't give up. Keep pushing. Come back and have another evaluation. Ask for a second opinion. Don't give up. These preschool years are precious. They are very short, and we have a short period of time to make a maximal lifelong impact.
And, you know, Megan, you also, as a parent, in those, you know, earlier weeks and months of his life, you watched him sort of fight through a number of challenges earlier, probably more than most kids.
Yes.
And, you know, when my son was 15 months, I remember he had croup. I mean, it was croup. I felt like I was being stabbed every time I heard him cough. It's just awful. It's really hard to watch your child struggle. Mm-hmm. Did you think back to those early weeks and months, some of the things that he was challenged with, and did you wonder what might be interconnected? Did those things come up in your mind?
Oh, I definitely did. In fact, when I filled out all the paperwork, I felt like I was writing already a lifelong story for a child that had only been on this planet for just 2 years. Because I thought maybe it was connected. You know, he had RSV, he had pneumonia, he had milk protein intolerance, so the insides of his intestines were wrecked. I thought somehow, especially with the RSV, and like you said, you're listening to them breathe. I'm like, did he not have enough oxygen? Did this do something to his brain? Like, or did I do something wrong? Did I not have him propped up enough? I mean, you go back and you run through everything. So I did mention it all, not knowing if it could be connected. And I probably over-documented because I was fearful that if I didn't, I would leave something out, that there would be like, oh, well, that's what we needed to provide something for him.
Sure. And so once he's two and you're starting through down the road of these services, was there a moment or a time where you thought, wow, we're definitely, this is what has to happen. We're on the right track. We're turning a corner.
Yes. The minute he could communicate that he was actually thirsty or hungry or actually say please and thank you. I mean, that was probably one of the first signs that he learned was please and thank you. And I look at it now, and he's such an empathetic kid that, you know, one of the first signs he did was please and thank you. I mean, he was truly kind when he was two.
That's amazing.
It is. I mean, he is an amazing kid, and I'm probably biased because I'm his mom. But
no, he's very, very sweet.
But I knew that he was getting what he needed, but it was clear that he had a long way to go, and that it was actually difficult for him. But when he was working with the therapist, once he kind of understood that they were helping him, you could see where he would grasp onto things because it would make his life easier.
So today you started by telling us at the outside of the hour that at 5 years old now, you know, he's doing really, really well here.
He's doing really well.
What do you want parents to understand about, because every child is unique, every person is unique, no question about that, but what has the last couple of years sort of been like, you know, in terms of the progress and in terms of the challenge that you see? What have those years been like for you and for Cooper, really?
It's an ebb and flow. As he usually progresses, maybe in the speech area, he kind of seems to plateau maybe PT or OT wise. And then maybe he'll kind of plateau in speech, and then he'll kind of take off in gross motor, do something. It's been a matter of detangling maybe what's the typical 5-year-old reaction versus something that's sensory. That's been really difficult for both myself and my husband. Because how you would parent or discipline is, it's different. You know, if he's having a sensory reaction, you know, then I'm not going to correct him the same way.
Sure. And to be clear with the sensory stuff, what's the kind of thing that might trigger a reaction?
Well, for Cooper, it can be kind of broad. There are times if something's too loud, he's overstimulated, or he just overreacts to it. Our biggest things are probably food and clothing. He has days where he absolutely cannot tolerate to wear certain things. So I have kind of like a small set of wardrobe that's, you know, maybe it's just fleece, and I've cut all the tags out and make sure that it's elastic and it's maybe a little oversized, so it's too big. He has a really hard time with smells and textures of food. He doesn't like being overly messy or sticky. Those are probably the biggest things right now.
And sometimes, and I think the film on XXI on Saturday is going to touch on this, behavioral issues can be a result of frustration with various things, sometimes an inability to communicate, early on especially. Did he have any of that frustration?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He definitely did. In fact,
Sarah's
early
got this look on his face like, yep, you're... Yeah.
He was labeled as a behavioral issue early on. And that's why I kept saying, no, it's not behavioral, because once he could communicate, then the behavior went away. So it wasn't just that he was trying to be a naughty kid.
Go ahead, please.
I think what was so important for Cooper is to get therapists that really understood his particular needs. Once Cooper understood that we weren't going to make him sit at a chair with his hands folded in his lap for 30 minutes, and it was okay to wiggle, it was okay to move, it was okay to be who you are, then he got with the program and he was willing to work really hard to make improvements in his speech and in his motor function. It's that the therapist working with him really needed to understand who he was and what he needed. And when he felt like, oh, you get me, I never saw Cooper as a behavior problem. He just needed things that were a little bit different than other kids his age.
Right.
He needed to be able to move, to wiggle.
Yes.
And to trust you. Cooper
absolutely
had some issues with trust, which I'm guessing still carry on.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, Cooper had one experience early on that, someone didn't quite get it, and it was at only 3 years old, sit there in a chair with your feet flat on the floor and your hands in your lap, and you're going to repeat the words, which obviously if he's working on those words, they're difficult, and a chip system. So if he got a word right, he got a chip, and if he didn't get it, he got it taken away. So it was viewed very much as, I think, punishment. And that approach didn't work for him. And it wasn't that the therapist was bad. It was just, they just didn't click. So for Cooper, he does much better with that warm, fuzzy Mary Poppins type approach.
I don't think anyone's ever described me as a warm, fuzzy Mary Poppins type.
he adores you.
Well, here's the thing. I remember meeting Cooper, and I remember Deb coming down the hall and saying to me, this little boy needs you. He really, really needs you. But he really has a hard time with new people, and he's very, very shy, and it really takes him some time to warm up. So I introduced myself to Cooper a few days when he was coming to see Deborah up and down the hall, hiding behind Mr. L. On the side, you had to pretend not to notice him, say hello. But what I realized very, very quickly for Cooper is that his whole body was disorganized. And your brain, you only have so much processing available at any one given time, and your body takes up a lot. So if you are having to worry about staying in your chair or balancing or how your shirt feels or how your feet feel and that this one shoe is really bothering me and I can't figure out how to move it, then you are not having the processing available to focus on being ready to learn or following directions or even the speech, which takes a lot of intricate motor. So I looked at Cooper and recognized pretty early, this little boy was so disorganized. He had to work so hard to figure out any of the things he wanted to do, that there were a lot of things that weren't worth the work. You're just going to give him something difficult and it doesn't matter to him. Why would he go through all of that effort to complete it? So you had to really work with Cooper and find, and this is true for all kids, it's all of our therapy is play-based, but it's not as though you use the same games with every child. You have to find out, what does that child like to do? What's going to motivate them to work with me? They don't work for you, they work with you. And then you can change. I can change any game I need to match what I need him to do. But he doesn't really know it. And then when he does, Cooper responded very well to, okay, two more of this, and then we'll do something you want. One more of this. I know it's hard. You can do it. That kind of interaction. But we had to be approaching Cooper from all sides because his issues were very global.
Right.
Well, and let me just kind of put a pin in this because Sarah mentioned before the hour began that it's important for all of us to remember that the multidisciplinary approach has borne a lot of fruit in this particular relationship with Cooper. But listening to you describe this, what it says to me is too often we focus on whatever person we're interacting with during the day, could be a spouse, could be a coworker, let alone a child with EI needs. We figure, what are you trying to improve? What are you working on? As opposed to, do you have other needs met? You know, are you well fed? Are you well rested? And if anybody is just sort of weighed down by other things, it is hard to pour into a task. Now you think of whether it's a kid like Cooper or kids with an EDI, if they're struggling to, again, stay in a chair or whatever the case may be, you may have a lot of different sort of things to unlock before you can even get to speech, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Is that fair?
I also think it's important to recognize that just like adults have bad days, kids have bad days. And I specifically remember one day that Cooper came in. He was completely dysregulated, completely shut down. And a little bit of probing with Mom and with Cooper, it was he had had to leave his house in a hurry, rush 45 minutes down the road to go do something, didn't want to do it, felt rushed, felt discombobulated. And as a result, he had nothing left. When he got to speech, he just couldn't, and it could very easily have erupted into this behavior, I'm going to do it my way, and you can't make me do otherwise. And all it really took was a little bit of, you know what, I see you've had a rough day today. Mm-hmm. What can we, and by the time we got done, I still got the stuff I needed done. Mm-hmm. But it took a few minutes to get Cooper to buy in. And that's true for all kids. They're allowed to have a bad day.
And Cooper also learned, too, that sometimes things do get rushed. Not everything can be. He's very structured. And some of the things we've had to teach him is to maybe go with the flow a little bit better. That for Cooper, dealing with things that maybe come up unexpectedly because he uses like a visual calendar for the day, we are trying to get away from it a little bit because if something pops up, but it's not on the visual calendar, he's got to learn to, it's okay. The unexpected necessarily isn't bad.
But there's one other word I want to make sure we key in here too. The unexpected, you say, isn't necessarily bad, or it's okay, as Deborah said, for a child to know you can have a bad day. Mm-hmm. But what I think some parents worry about, and I'm hearing this a little from Megan, especially early in a child's life where you may be struggling to figure out what's, do we even have a diagnosis? Do we fully understand what's wrong? What is causing agitation? The worry that a child could be labeled a bad kid or a kid that's a problem kid is really acute for a lot of parents. And especially when you're kind of reaching, trying to figure out, going, I know this kid in there. I know the sweetness of this child. But what people may see is, you know, this day there was a meltdown or this day there, and that can be really, really hard to feel like, I don't want you to label my kid a bad kid. What did you go through with that?
Oh, well, it hurts. I mean, you don't, as a parent, you don't want your kid to be the kid who's acting out or bad or, you know, figuring that they're going to push someone else around because maybe they don't know how to properly communicate, and therefore then it's perceived on the other end that they're almost like a bully, or you don't want your kid picked on because they can't properly communicate either their needs. You worry about your kid getting bullied. It honestly, more than hurt, it's probably more fear on a parent's part that, mm-hmm. that you honestly worry about it. And that was the other thing, just constantly communicating, asking, okay, well, this situation happened the other day. How do I deal with that? Or how do I help maybe the preschool teacher deal with it?
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
This speaks to the Google point.
Yes.
Because it really, we go to school for a long time. And part of our training is to figure out how to discern. How do you discern between behavioral and sensory? Or I'm looking at a child and realizing that it isn't that they don't want to be able to do that activity. They truly can't. So I call them robust avoidance behaviors often happen. And you see a kiddo who's orbiting the room. And it's not because they don't want to play. It's that they don't know how to organize their bodies to play. So they avoid it, or they sit down and go in the corner and they don't want to do the different tasks. But we have been trained to recognize those kiddos and be able to tease it out and think to ourselves, you know what, he really can do this with some help, or that child can't do that yet. That's why we're not going to ask them to do that yet. We're going to go meet them where they are and then help bring them forward, because this game is something they should be able to play at their age or their level of development or whatever it may be. But that's why if you were to just Google those symptoms, you might label your child something or not label them something, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't really know. And honestly, to discern between a sensory processing issue, possibly a motor control issue, an apraxia issue, or a behavioral issue, That takes a lot of expertise, a lot of observation, a lot of clinical interactions.
Well, thank goodness there are the professionals in the field to help with that. And as we go to our only break of the hour, it's going to sound a little preachy, but I think it's important to kind of, for me to keep reminding myself, there aren't bad kids.
No.
There aren't bad kids. There are kids who may do things that are, you know, sort of an incident. Even a kid who bullies is not a bad kid. It's probably a hurt kid. But there's so much, I think, much more complex about it. So I'm just grateful for the story that Megan is sharing about Cooper, her remarkable five-year-old, and Dr. Sarah Callis is here from the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Deborah Cicery is here from the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Valerie Stotz is a licensed speech-language pathologist and preschool administrator. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back, and we'll answer some questions. I've got a question from a listener in particular about milestones and crawling in particular, because Sarah mentioned crawling, and you know, I know milestones can make parents nervous, so we'll hit that as well. And then we'll kind of bring you up to speed. We'll kind of close the loop on Cooper's remarkable story and talk about some things that we all ought to be thinking about with our own kids and our own families. That's coming up next. I'm Evan Dawson, host of Connections on WXXI. On Tuesday, we bring you full coverage from NPR and national coverage as the Senate prepares to open the impeachment trial against President Donald Trump. Full live coverage beginning at noon. You will hear all of it on WXXI as always, and Connections is back with you on Wednesday. This is Connections, and this is the Dialogue on Disability right here on Connections, an annual tradition, multiple conversations throughout this week with some, I know I use this word a lot, but really remarkable parents and people and providers across our community. And Megan has been sharing Cooper's story. And so is there an average day for Cooper now? What's life like in Cooper's world right now?
He's much more put together. He likes to know exactly what day of the week it is and mm-hmm. what's coming up. And he knows on what days he goes to preschool. He knows on what days he goes to therapies. And he's definitely a little bit more, I guess, maybe mellow. But him going to therapy and to preschool, it does. It takes a lot out of him. So when he's home, he wants to be home and he wants to be relaxed. And to a certain extent, he needs a good 20 minutes to kind of decompress, and he'll tell me, I'm on vacation. That's where I'm on vacation. You know, so I mean, like Christmas break was like he had 2 weeks. He was on vacation. He was not doing anything that, you know, unless it was definitely mm-hmm. Cooper approved. But he's
I love it.
Cooper approved, yes.
And yeah, you know, so the importance of not surprising him too often seems pretty clear in this conversation. That he likes to be able to know what's coming his way.
He likes to know what's coming his way, but I do deliberately try to throw something in there because
to basically help him get used to it?
To help him get used to it, because life's not going to tell you every single day. School, you know, kindergarten, you're going to have things that are thrown in there that aren't with the schedule. And you do have to know at least how to try to adapt to that. And I don't want him in a situation where I have planned everything out to the point that it's later on going to cause him a deficit. So
let me ask you about your appreciation for the work that these providers have offered. What has it meant for your family?
When we first started, it was tantrums and crying, and it was me crying, and it was arguments, you know, with my husband, and it wasn't arguments that were meant to be hurtful, but it was just trying to desperately do the right thing for him and feeling like that we didn't know what to do. So the fact that we found them and that they've made such a difference, it literally has changed Cooper and the direction in life that he was going. I don't think he would be the same kid without them.
Yeah, Megan, last year we spoke with providers and families throughout this community about early intervention. There's been a long-running conversation about a lot of different layers of it, but a concern that we don't have either the services, the people, the funding. I don't think we pay people enough. I mean, there's a lot of things.
Oh, they're definitely underfunded. I mean, they do not get paid enough.
And this is not me being a homer. I mean, they're underfunded. And the reimbursement rates aren't, the hourly rate we pay people, not enough. I mean, these things we now, it's very clear. Just when you watch the migration of professionals in the field, it's not, right now, it's not satisfactory. So I want to ask you two questions before I turn to all of them about this. This is important because now we're going to kind of pivot to where we go as a community here. Your son is 5 now.
He is 5.
He really started services at 2?
At 2.
What do you think life would be like as a 5-year-old if he had none of those services?
I think, honestly, I mean, he still wouldn't be ready to go to kindergarten next year. I think that he behaviorally there would be issues because it would have been learned based off of what he couldn't do, if that makes sense. I don't know. I mean, it's what I feared initially, but now, I mean, we're in a different spot. He would be all miscombobulated and anxiety-wise, it would be much worse. Self-esteem. We've had issues with self-esteem. That's pretty scary. Four years old last year was really, really rough. I don't know. I think honestly, you know, mental health wise, I don't think he'd be in a great place at 5 years old.
In a moment, I'm going to ask Deborah to tell us a little bit more about her views on the importance of really sort of starting early. Valerie and Deborah and Sarah can tell us about starting as young as possible and what that means. But in this community now, considering we've had what became kind of a political debate during an election year, but an ongoing debate about, well, should the state fund more? What's the county's role, et cetera? As a parent, if you get the chance to be in the room with policymakers, what do you want them to know about early intervention in this community?
Well, if you help them when they're young enough, I mean, these kids are what the future is. And if you can give them the best leg up, I mean, to help them and give them a leg up right at the beginning to possibly stop something that could get worse, why wouldn't you? I mean, if all these children are supposed to be the future and the future leaders, and why would you not? I mean, that's where the money should go and should be spent. It's kind of silly because, I don't know, it doesn't make sense not to do it.
Well, all right, let's do some softballs then. Valerie is a licensed speech pathologist and a preschool administrator. First, how important is it to start kids on services as young as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. The ages between birth to 5 are huge developmental years. So if you guide them as they're developing, you're far better ahead than to have them go through that development period. Then they go enter school. Now they have even more issues that are worse. It's far more expensive to address the issues in the school age than to do it in early intervention and the preschool years. And we have many kids that are discharged before they enter kindergarten and they're done, and now they can continue with their school life.
So when it comes to improving what's available in this county and in this region, and that means paying better, attracting more people, and keeping more in the field, I guess I'll just ask you do you look to any one direction? Is it New York State's responsibility? Is there a county component? I mean, who's most to blame for the fact that if we agree right now it's not satisfactory, who do you blame the most?
Oh, I'm not going to place blame.
Okay, no, well, see, I got to ask you. That's my job.
It's definitely state ed and county are both working in the preschool area to in order to fund the services. So what part each plays and what they're, of course, they're looking at the other budgets. But obviously, this is so important to provide these services.
So you're not going to apportion to any layer of government any sort of share of the blame, but what you're saying is there's a need for more.
They're both a part of it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's fair enough. All right. So, Deborah Cicery, you may also dodge that question. I'm just kidding. but part of our job is trying to really understand in the community.
Right.
If we don't have what we need, how are we going to get it? Do you have some thoughts on that?
I do. I think without assigning blame, I think we need to recognize this isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
People are leaving in droves, leaving the birth to 5 service provision because it's difficult work. It's not financially rewarding. It is rewarding in a whole lot of other ways, though. And that's why those of us who stay, we stay because of kids like Cooper. But recognizing that this is not working, and we need to figure out as a community, how do we make this job more attractive to young professionals and the professionals that are already in it? How do we make it so that they want to stay, so that they want to change lives like Cooper's?
Do you have a magic wand on how to get those professionals?
I do think that Valerie's point is well taken. You either pay now or you pay later.
Yeah.
And I think we need to decide that when children are birth to five, their brains are more malleable, they're easier to treat. We're able to make changes for a longer period of time in a short window. Mm-hmm. If you wait till kids have been making the same error patterns for 8, 9, 10 years, it's much harder to fix. And we need to take advantage of that time when their brains are more receptive.
Okay. Dr. Callis?
I think everyone should pay. I think it should come from everywhere, honestly. Yeah. I think every single level of government, county, state, federal, I think it's an investment in our future. And I agree with what both of the ladies said. I can help a kiddo change now, and it's not rehabilitation. It's habilitation. I'm teaching them how to do something in a way that helps them organize. You know, kids have orchards for brains, and you have to prune. You have to get organized in order for your orchard to bloom and have lots of fruit. And our job is to help them do that, because for a multitude of reasons, kiddos aren't developing correctly, or they're just missed a few basic fundamental milestones. And if I can help them right now put those into place, then they can be more organized. And that helps them succeed in so many other levels of development and education and become these professionals. Who knows what Cooper's going to be? It's going to be amazing. But I think we all have to invest. This can't be one level's responsibility, because if every single person in government had a child who had special needs, we would have more money. Because they would see the personal effect, and they would live Megan's story, and they would say, no one wants to not have what their child needs.
Isn't that so true, though?
Because his trajectory has completely changed. Completely. His attitude, his willingness.
The day he rode the bike,
I
was
cried.
The best day ever.
Can you tell this story?
You can tell it, yeah.
So there's some sort of bike rodeo at the school.
Yes, and I was mortified.
And they were both terrified. We spent a lot of, that's the other thing you get at our level with the early intervention in the preschools. We do a lot of working with the parents, a lot of talking, a lot of educating. We then give parents tools to take home and work on, which is so much more effective. You cannot diet once a week and expect it to work. So I give you tools. I use them. You use them. I give you variations that you can do at home. And that way the kiddo gets it every day. That's really, really important.
And
Sorry.
You get to ask
Sidebar.
The question and prune it right there. Because, and let me tell you, I asked a lot of questions.
Megan asked a lot of questions, but that's okay. We love parents who ask questions. Okay, so there's the bike rodeo, and they're both terrified about it, and there's no way Cooper can participate because he can't ride a bike, but he really, really wants to. And I said, why can't he ride a bike? Of course we can ride a bike. So we brought the bike to the clinic, and we worked. We started right where he was. We started working on pushing it. We started getting on and off. We started doing other coordination skills separately that would help him be able to pedal this bike. And it was a lot of self-confidence, because at that point, we'd been working well. He had a lot of the skills he needed. We were able, at El Segal, we're riding in the hallways. They let us do so much. Thank you very, very much for the facilities there that let us ride bikes inside. And we got him on the bike, and he was so proud of himself. And I really think Megan cried. I'm pretty sure you cried.
Oh, I cried.
Because she's wanting to hang on and she's not sure he can do it. And I'm saying, no, he's okay. We can do this. He can do this. We've done all the prep. And he rode the bike down the hall and it was fabulous. And then he went to the rodeo.
He did.
And he participated.
And he participated. And he even said to me, he's like, Mommy, I'm just like the rest of them. I rode my bike. And he,
that's awesome.
And that was the thing, is for him, He was just a normal kid. He could do it.
Good for Al Segal, by the way, for saying, there you go.
Oh, yeah.
Take
Absolutely.
That hallway.
Yep. The people who do awesome what we story. Do and who work with us doing what we do, really, everyone gives everything they've got.
It's an awesome story. Before I grab one more phone call, I mean, I think Sarah's point is something we should probably remember. And I sometimes may sound like an advocate instead of a journalist, but we interview a lot of people and a lot of families. And sometimes journalists and, frankly, also politicians can get siloed and not really know who's hurting or suffering in communities. And when you meet kids who have no defense against whatever their challenges they have, And you see providers literally leaving the business because they can barely support themselves. It's hard to draw any other conclusions. And Sarah's point about, well, if leaders in government had kids who needed EI, EI would be funded more.
Yep.
Well, when leaders in government finally had a gay daughter, we got same-sex marriage. That's what it took. So we're in a society where it's motivated self-interest. And maybe we should elect some people who, that's not necessarily the standard. I don't know. That's enough of that soapbox. Sorry, everybody. Bonnie.
Very good point.
Bonnie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah. Hi. I've kind of talked about this in the past, and I spoke at the County Ledge meeting X number of months ago when the whole issue of the preschool program was being discussed, and some of the things that have already been said now or also said then in terms about people's ability to continue to do the work, the pay. And I want to keep reminding people because it speaks exactly to what you're talking about, and that is after 1970 when the consent decree indicating that no longer shall we, you know, institutionalize people as a main means of how we interact with people. So through the years, from there until the early 2000s, that initiative, as well as having to be funded by the state over the years, really put together. It was an amazing coalition of people. It was an amazing outcome in the sense of the quality of the people, the things that the folks that you're interviewing are talking about, how people interact, interdisciplinary teams in quadrants. I mean, it was a very good, very, very good model, high quality, a lot of civil rights issues because that was during the time of some of the earlier civil rights. So a lot of factors came together. And this outreach program's connected to some of these local programs. So you were getting, working to miss gaps. And, you know, the who pays, of course, there's a philosophical belief that, you know, the local people should pay some, i.e. in county monies. Yeah, and that's fine, except that there's no way in this world that you're going to have a consistent quality program with the things you're talking about now, the pay and all that kind of stuff and the quality of people and blah, blah. There is no way without the state making a huge commitment. I don't mean necessarily huge in billions of dollars, but understanding without that significant increase and consistency with money, there's no way the county is going to be able to make up for it, you know, short-term, long-term, whatever. So, you know, one of the things that I was telling people is, you know, you ought to have a public hearing, and you ought to have the county people and the state people have to say publicly, to not just people with disabilities, but everybody, listen, this, you know, because in the early 2000, the governor did away, the program I was describing, totally did away with it. Not just pieces did away with it, totally did away with it. And the reason mainly is because, you know, let's be honest here. Some of this is hard to say. But, you know, we have a society that wants to figure out how to do things fast, quick, and with as little money as possible. And, you know, we have wealthy people who aren't paying what they should. So all that comes home. And unfortunately, the governor, who probably didn't even know what was going on anyway, you know, just ended it. And when I say ended it, it was no, like, you know, okay, we're going to end it in 3 years. It was, oh, it's gone. And you can verify that by people who were in the administrative support system then. So you've got this situation where there is no way, it's not going to be funded consistently meeting the needs you're talking about without that piece. So something has to happen to confront the you know, the county doesn't want to hurt the state because the state gets mad at them, and, you know, all this kind of garbage. That has to come out in the public, and we can't just be so nice about it. And when I gave the testimony to the legislature, I talked to some of the staff, the clinical staff afterwards, and I was amazed that they don't even have a connection with county pay. You know, there's nothing, I don't know how they, you know, it sounds like it's like a mobile, people just hanging on to, you know, as long as they can do it. But it's a crime because they didn't, service coordinators, which are key to these programs, were, you know, like saying, I can't do the job anymore. I know it's a hard job. I did it for 30 years, but it's a rewarding job. People should not have to be feeling like they're, you know, a burden because sure, the state doesn't want to pay. So, you know, there's a whole thing about this, and I've kind of thrown in fast details here, but it needs to be looked at every single time we talk about this so we can stop this pattern. Otherwise, it will never stop because one area wants to blame the, you know, I'll give, you know, you get less money so I can go around telling people I save tax money. Well, so,
Bonnie, thank you very much. And our guests will be thrilled to know that we're almost out of time, so they don't have time to respond because they have tried to be nice. And Bonnie says it's time to not be nice about this, to be blunt about it. And Bonnie, I will just say, given that they've said that, you know, they don't want to apportion blame heavily, but we take the point. Bonnie's saying that the state is in the level of government that could really fund it more. Let's find out what happens in the legislative session this year. Let's find out what the Bellow administration can do in terms of working with the state, because they've got relationships there. It's part of what Adam Bellow ran on, and we'll see. Thank you, as always, Bonnie. And we're almost out of time there. So I just want to thank our guests here. This is the first of our Dialogue on Disability, multiple conversations this week. And you're going to meet some outstanding people providing services and families like Megan and Cooper. Megan, thank you for sharing Cooper's story, and here's to continued success.
You.
We know it's not a straight line, but boy, don't ever hang a little fist bump from Dr. Callis. Thank you for
Thank you for letting me share it.
You got it. And Dr. Sarah Callis, physical therapist and the lead physical therapy and occupational therapy clinician at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Valerie Stotz, who is a licensed speech language pathologist and preschool administrator. Thank you very much, Valerie.
Thank you.
And Deborah Sistery, who is a licensed speech language pathologist at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
So not surprised that our friends at Al Siegel are opening up all the kind of doors and hallways when they need to. Great stuff there. Thanks to the whole team today. Bob volunteering. Thank you, Bob. And Megan Mack is the producer. Emma Ray Stein is interning with us. And Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.